Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When it comes to the Occupy movement, where do artists fit in? 99% of artists in New York surely fall within the rest of the 99% in the larger society, but art can be very expensive, and guess who often buys the art and runs the museums and patronizes the galleries? A recent solo show by New York artist William Pohida at Postmaster's Gallery in Chelsea was called Derivatives and tackled those questions head on. He's known for naming names in this show, from art critics and fellow artists to bankers and politicians. And he joins me now. William Pohida, welcome to WNYC.
Hi.
You started this particular show before Occupy Wall Street got underway, and there's a link to many of the works at Postmaster's site on our webpage. What inspired the show?
Well, it's been a long-standing interest of mine to try to examine the relationship between the artists and collectors and kind of challenge the power structures in the art world. And, you know, I've had a kind of long-standing interest in the economics of art and how it works and trying to kind of uncover those things through the different projects that I've been doing. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to take an example, Griftopia, which is the name of one of the works. It's based on Mataibbi's book title. He was here to talk about that book pertaining to the banks and et cetera. And it sketches out from left to right all the political and economic players in the book with sketches and intricate lines of text connecting them. Did that help you process the information?
Yes and no. I found Taibbi's book to be incredibly illuminating and, you know, but I still didn't. I came at it from the perspective of not really understanding exactly what caused the financial crisis. And his book helped me to understand that, but it was such a complex kind of labyrinth. You know, he calls it this labyrinthine system, that it really is hard to make it any clearer. And so the drawing became more about trying to show that kind of confusion and, you know, coming from an artist perspective. Trying to understand the complexity of derivatives and the causes of the financial crisis. And my interest in that stemmed from the fact that the art world is so connected to the 1%. You know, I came into the art world in the aughts, you know, 2002, 2003, and it was experiencing this great boom. And, you know, I think there's a kind of level of uncomfortability for most artists to believe that this growth was fueled by what ultimately caused the financial crisis.
You know, it doesn't make someone evil. It doesn't make someone part of the problem just because they do have money.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think there's been a lot of mutual interest with the collectors that I've met that are part of the 1% who come at it not because I'm making fun of them, but they're also interested in the economics of art and how their industries connect and overlap with the art market. You know, but I mean, there was a period where you had a lot of hedge funders who were making money in ways that may have contributed to some of our current woes, buying a lot of art and supporting the market, you know, and putting everyone in a kind of awkward position.
So when you name names, so to speak, of critics and collectors, do you feel you're jeopardizing your career, or why do you out people and as what?
If you want to critique the art world and you just do it in generalities, it just becomes stereotypes. If you actually can talk about specific people and their relationships, you know, I think it gives it a little bit more of the critique a little bit more power. And you can really look at the, you know, what's going on in a specific case. I think it's difficult just to speak only in generalities about the art world.
So give us a specific case of something that happened in the art world that you feel, what, corrupts the art, or what's the issue?
Well, I mean, probably the most famous example of it or anything that I've been involved with was the kind of new museum controversy where Dacus Janu was a trustee at the new museum, and they presented a show of his work from his private foundation, the Desti Foundation. And it seemed to violate a number of sort of museum ethical standards. It's not something that was very common. And, you know, he also chose an artist in his collection, Jeff Koons, to be the curator. And it sort of sidelined the traditional museum staff and potentially could have increased the value of, Mr. Janu's work. The drawing that I did about it was on the cover of the Brooklyn Rail and kind of helped fuel the discussion about what was happening and ultimately, is indicative of artists' relationship to the 1% tends to be. He ended up buying one of the prints, Mr. Janu. And, it really points to the fact that the 1% does have a lot of power in controlling what we see and what we value as really good art.
Put on your headphones because we'll take a couple of phone calls for you. And Joel in Union is the first caller. Hi, Joel. You're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian. This is an extremely vital discussion since the traditional role of art is, one of them is to critique our societies and political systems. I produced some explicitly political work, put it in a little book, shopped it around Paris, photographed Occupy La Défense. I have a gallery in New York who's interested in my crowd pictures, even of Occupy Wall Street, but he wants to do them from an aesthetic perspective. Also, there's a gallery in Beacon, New York.
In other words, he wants to depoliticize your political art?
That's right. Like crowds. I have a bar scene in Coney Island and then a crowd scene in Zuccotti Park, and those would be put together. There's a gallery in Beacon called Fovea, mm-hmm. which is avowedly political. There's another one in New York. I forget which one it is. But
I'm going to leave it there so I can get some other people on. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting story about how a gallery potentially wants to show his art but put it in a different context that makes it less political, maybe more easy to sell as a result.
Of course, yeah.
Eric in Long Island City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Hi, I'm an artist, and I thought it's a good point about the influence of the 1% on art, but in general I think the vast majority of artists are not supported by the 1%. Most artists don't sell their work for millions of dollars, and those artists are supported more by the middle class or the upper middle class, people who, might, try, buy their first piece of art, not by a superstar, but by, a working artist who's trying to make a living, just like anybody else.
It's a good point, right?
No, it's a very good point. And I think, it speaks to this idea that, we have this idea that you can be a professional artist nowadays and make a living off of it. But if we're talking about selling 10 to 20 pieces a year to an upper middle class family, it's not going to create the kind of income you need to survive in New York. And that's the case for 99% of the artists. We're not able to generate an income. I still have to teach part time.
I was going to say, it's that plus teaching.
Yeah.
You made it from Williamsburg to a Chelsea gallery. Can you still be as critical when you're moving up the chart of art world power?
I can try to be. I don't know exactly how it impacts my career negatively. I mean, I hear a lot. There's a lot of comments, but I think there are things that I just won't know because I won't be offered, and you don't hear about those things.
You won't be offered probably a big mural in the lobby of Goldman Sachs.
No.
As Julie Meritu comes up in your show, she was commissioned to do a big mural for their lobby right before the crash, we should mention. And if you go see your work, you can only view it from the street unless you have an ID and you ask in one of your works, did Julie Meritu really understand what Goldman Sachs does?
I have to ask that question. I mean, as artists, we produce works and then we put them out on an open market and anyone could potentially buy those. Sometimes we don't even know who buys the work. We can just say it's in a private collection because the buyer may remain anonymous.
Would you not sell to a Wall Street firm? Is that blanket for you?
I don't know if I can make that decision, as an artist, because once it's put for sale in the gallery, I don't know. I think there's a kind of moral right that I could try to ask that, but I'm not sure that that's something that you can do. Whereas with a commission, you accept that up front. You know who you're making the work for and possibly how they make their money. And I'm not sure anybody did, really before the financial crisis exactly how they were making their money. But, as a piece of public art, it really is not, it's hard to see. And it I think she said something about the work trying to show the Oh, no, I'm spacing. I mean, really, just the arrogant hand of capitalism.
Doing art above the heads of her patrons a little bit.
Yeah.
That's probably not the first time that's been done. No. All right. William Pohida. People have compared you, by the way, to William Hogarth, the English satirist of the 1700s. You like that comparison?
I do, and satire can be sometimes a little bit mean.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank
we really
you.
Appreciate it. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.